Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our show, Empowering Caregivers. I am your host, Susan Bida, co-founder of eCareDiary.com. eCareDiary.com is a new website for families caring for loved ones who are aging or going through the long-term care process. We are a centralized website to provide families free online tools, resources, and a community of caregivers who are experienced and can provide you the mentoring help that you might need through the process. The goal here is really to help empower families so that they can become better health managers and advocates for their loved ones. Today, it is my pleasure to introduce you to our very special guest, Marjorie Papst. Marjorie is a nationally acclaimed author, speaker, and facilitator. Her fourth book, Enrich Your Caregiving Journey, will be discussed today and explores how successful caregivers can take care of themselves while they're caring for others. The book actually won this year's 2010 Caregiver Friendly Award by Today's Caregiver National Magazine. Marjorie is also the founder and president of the Pabst Charitable Foundation for the Arts. And on top of all that, Marjorie is eCare Diary's very own expert on the topics of caring for the caregiver. She has written numerous articles for us to help caregivers with specific techniques and tips on how to cope with caring for a loved one. Marjorie, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Susan, for that generous introduction and for inviting me today.
It's such a pleasure to have you on. I'd love to start asking you about what inspired you to write Enrich Your Caregiving Journey. It's such a fabulous book and such an amazing resource for caregivers. So tell us a little bit about what was the inspiration.
Absolutely. I was a caregiver three times. And in each instance, I did certainly some things wrong, like we all do. And on top of that, I found it to be quite a lonely endeavor, as I know many of those caregivers who are listening to us have found out as well. And it was very difficult to find resources that weren't, I guess you might say, clinical. Clinical resources were great, but I was really looking for something that would be comforting, that would be kind of tips-oriented, that would be practical things I could do with my loved one that would make things easier. And I never found that resource, so I decided to write it myself.
Oh, that's wonderful, Marjorie. And you are touching on something that I completely agree with you on, and that is that many, I think, people who are going through the caregiving experience, they're shocked into the experience of a loved one falling ill, or they're gradually experiencing it because their loved one is going through a long-term illness. But I think many families underestimate the emotional aspects of caregiving. And I think depending on the patient and the size of the family, there are so many different players involved in the mix, and even if you don't have a large family. And what I love about your book is that it puts a very big spotlight on emotions and value systems. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
You bet. Yes, and it was one of those discoveries that I made. And so I guess that's why I'm able to write so, you know, poignantly about it, is that, of course, we all start off with those tasks, those practical everyday to-dos that we need to do, medications and meals and all those kinds of things. And it isn't until you're into the process you often think, well, why am I a different person? Why am I feeling differently than I've normally felt? Why do I have these conflicting feelings? And then as time goes on, it can even turn into feelings of guilt, and then feelings of relief if your loved one is admitted to the hospital, and then you feel even worse. So I began to realize it's that emotional component for both you and, as you mentioned, your loved one, and right, for your entire family. And that the other thing that you mentioned were values, and some of the old family patterns, shall we say, often reemerge because now, you know, something that was perhaps a felt thing years ago becomes quite large between you and a sibling when you have a parent ill, for example. And so it is managing that that emotional thing that is really the key to then helping you do every other part of the caregiving process.
And you give such very practical tools to help identify emotions, and to you encourage readers of the book, who I assume would be caregivers and family members, to really list them out and provide reasons and values associated with those emotions and the reasons for those emotions. So let's talk a little bit about the three families that you cover in the book. They're very unique, and they're going through a fascinating set of circumstances, not only in terms of ailment, but also family dynamics. Could you tell us about these three families and why you selected them for your book?
Well, first of all, I wanted to make sure that while often caregiving does involve an older person, you're caring for an older person, that it certainly is not exclusive to that. And I'm sure many of your listeners today are perhaps caring for a child or a spouse or a friend who is at midlife, let's say. So I wanted to make sure that the stories in the book covered the wide age demographics across the age groups, because we don't want to leave out anyone. The other piece is I wanted to show how remarkably similar caregiving is, whether you're caring for a child or for an adult or for a senior, that the dynamics are very much the same. So when the reader gets to the end of the book, even though they have over 130 tips about managing the emotions and the values within each of the families, what they really come out with are a set of tips that they can say, oh, this is applicable across the board. Things like attending to emotions, attending to the values of people in your family. One of the places where emotions really get mixed up is when the caregiver makes the assumption that his or her value is going to be the same as perhaps that patient's or that loved one's value or another member of the family's values. And I found that once I sorted out, oh, this person has a different value on this than I do, it became remarkably clearer as to how to manage the dynamics in a family and thus how to ward off some of the more emotional stresses of the caregiving role.
It's amazing what you learn about how people that you think you've known for most of your life react so differently under very different, extenuating circumstances.
Absolutely. And yet when you look at it, you say, oh, yes, of course, that would have happened. I remember my mother and father when my mother became ill. She had cancer. And all of a sudden, my father was into, because one of his primary goals or one of his values was privacy. So he immediately assumed that she would want privacy and that we would all want privacy. Whereas my mother was quite a gregarious person, and she said, oh, no, I'd like to see my friends. So my brother and I realized quickly, early on, that their value systems were really clashing when it came to honoring everybody. So in the end, that's what we tried to do, and we did that with a lot of circumstances. And I found the same thing was true when I was caring for my husband, that his values might be different from mine. And so I had to work out collaborative solutions that would be good for both of us. And
Well, you know, Marjorie, what I find so fascinating about this book, and particularly in the beginning chapters, is that you really encourage the caregiver to step back, because they can certainly get overwhelmed with all the things that you mentioned before, the day-to-day activities, but you're really giving them the questions and the tools to really step back and focus on all of the players in the circle of care, so to speak, so that they can better manage. And I think it's so important that you do make that an important focus in your book, because I think so many families neglect to do that. I know in my own family situation, it was really not even about focusing on emotions and rather dealing with finding medical professionals, the right medical professions. And then what happens often is that you get to this sort of this inflection point where things tend to blow up. And I think your recommendations are really very, very key, because emotional conflicts can certainly add tremendous amount of stress.
Yes, absolutely. And to recognize the signs before those conflicts occur, to perhaps ward them off, if you will. And that requires one-on-one communication with people in your family. It's what you're saying is so important, and yet it's one of those things that in a few instances I forgot to do. And because you almost feel as a caregiver, oh gosh, I don't have the time to talk with my brother and my sister and, you know, kind of get their feelings about things and their orientation before a decision is made. And yet if you don't do that on the front end, it takes you more time to resolve the conflicts that can ensue if you haven't, like you say, stepped back, thought about it, said, how can I make my job easier? Who do I need to speak with now so that I don't accrue all of these bad feelings and conflicts later? It can make such a huge difference.
Yes. Well, Marjorie, you know, this month our theme in July, because we're in the midst of summer and people, a lot of people are on vacations and finding restful times for themselves to recuperate. I think this month is very important for caregivers, because many caregivers are not able to get some rest and relaxation away from their obligations and caring for a loved one. This month we are devoting it to caring for the caregiver, and I really like your chapter 4, which is all about focusing on a plan and finding people who have unique strengths and skills to be involved. And I was really touched actually by one sentence in this chapter where one of the family members, Pat Williams, who's caring for her ailing son, she says that an unwritten rule in her family is that asking for help was seen as a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
I was really very touched by that, because I know so many people who feel that way and feel the need to take on everything for themselves. Can you talk a little bit about this chapter and what you want people to take away from this?
Sure. It was the hardest thing I had to do. And so I felt like I needed to write about it. And in fact, if there is a theme that is continual through every chapter, it is the ask for help theme. It is the single most difficult thing for any caregiver to do, and that is ask for help. And yet, once one does it, in even a small way, it opens the gateway of possibilities that are unending. And so I would encourage all your viewers today to promise themselves to say, if I'm not asking for help, let me pick one small thing I can do. In the chapter 4 that you mentioned about creating a plan, I suggest that you start small and you find a trusted person who is a person that can begin to, where you can begin to develop a caring community of people. But find a person who you believe is willing and who has a specific skill that is better than any of your skills in that specific area, and ask them for their help in helping you and your loved one. And first of all, they will be empowered and delighted to do it. And second of all, it will certainly free you and as you said, give you some time so you can care for yourself.
Right.
And as importantly, I believe whenever I did this, the person I was caring for, I think of my husband in particular, He never wanted me to leave his side. But when I finally did it and asked another person to come in and help with a certain specific thing, it really empowered him as well. It really made his life more exciting and more varied. And he found out he liked it. Hello. So what that allowed me to do then was to then begin to enlarge my caring community of people with whom I could collaborate. So then I was able to add more people and more specific things that they could do to help us. It was the most freeing thing, and yet it was the thing I put off and put off and put off. So please, caregivers out there, there's one thing that you take away from this conversation with Susan and I. It is to promise yourself to ask for help, to start small, and then go from there.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting about this chapter is you also talk about dealing with negative people as well. I mean, there may be some people in your circle of care who have to be involved, but may not necessarily be the most, you know, helpful in the sense of, you know, making the patient feel comfortable. So there are even tasks that they can handle, perhaps.
Absolutely.
In a positive way.
Exactly. You know, because the person's needs, the loved one's needs, come in several areas, physical, medical, meal preparation, keeping the home clean, recreational in relationships and so on. And so, like you say, I think if you've got a, you know, somewhat dysfunctional member of your family who must
sure.
be involved, who insists on being involved, give them some tasks that are not, you know, where they're not directly relating to the patient all the time.
Right.
Send them, you know, it's their job to go and get the medications, for example. It's their
yeah.
job to make the beds every morning. It's, you know, whatever. I think, you know, it's that whole thing about idle hands, you know, keeping
right.
them busy
right.
can really go a long way, too.
Sure can.
Yeah, exactly. And then that, and because people who are somewhat dysfunctional often are people who want to have something to do. And the more
sure.
you give them to do, their self-esteem will build, and hopefully the less dysfunctional they will become over time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about family and the so-called family meeting. And
yeah.
I completely agree with what you say in the book about how important timing is to ensuring the success of a family meeting. And what I also loved about the book was that for the first time, I had never seen a conflict scale, and I was actually so pleased to see it because it helped me to kind of figure out, okay, where does my family fit on this conflict scale, and when do I need to bring an outsider? So can you elaborate on this for the audience a little bit?
You bet. The conflict scale is very simple. It just simply says, let's say that you have 7 members in your immediate family, and let's say that one of those members is one of those people that's a bit dysfunctional, you know, tends to say the wrong thing at the wrong time and that kind of thing. Well, normally a family can manage that one person. You as a caregiver can manage that one person. You can rally people around, and all of you can keep that person busy and so on. But on this conflict scale, if you have 2 people who are not cooperating and not being a part of the team, it's at that point that it's probably, out of, let's say, 7 people, it's probably a good idea to call in an outside resource. Now, what do I mean by that? I just mean somebody who is perhaps a social worker,
mm-hmm.
Another pair of eyes, perhaps a friend who has a business that's related to relationship skills,
mm-hmm.
But somebody who can come in and help you manage that family meeting, because I find that often families behave a lot better if there's an outside person who comes in, especially
oh.
if there are more than 2 or more people are giving the whole family a hard time.
Absolutely.
And then that allows you as a caregiver to step aside and to be more objective and to really watch the dynamics of what are happening. I've never had to do this, but I have friends who have. And they have reported that once they were able to stand back and watch the family meeting going on, they discerned behaviors they'd never seen before, and it gave them insights and things that they could do after the meeting that would help resolve some of the issues that were going on.
Right. Well, yeah. I think that's tremendous advice, and I think that scale, I mean, it was the first time I could really visually understand how to measure that.
Because, thank you. Well, and it's so simple, isn't it? I mean, the scale itself is very simple, and yet
it really is.
You know, the application is, as you say, can be profound for a family.
Right. Yes. You also talk about, I mean, all of these, you know, the scale and having the family meeting. I mean, at the end of the day, this is really helping the one person who does, the caregiver who falls into the leadership role position. Even though a whole family is involved, there is one person who does need to take a leadership role. And I think having the family meeting, understanding the conflict scale, these are all tools to help the caregiver. And in the next chapter, you talk about carving out space and time for the caregiver. And at one point, you even talk about how with all the things that a caregiver has to worry about. I hate to use the word worry because no caregivers shouldn't see this as worrying, but I mean, sometimes, you know, you do worry about a variety of things that you're responsible for. And but what I thought was so neat at the end was where you talk about caregivers should plan a time of celebration. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I believe in celebration, and I believe whether they be big or small or mid-sized. And the reason that I focused on celebration as the book moves toward a conclusion is that we often think of celebrations as to having to be big things. And yet, as caregivers, we know that it's a moment-to-moment, day-to-day. And so our days are measured differently when we're in the caregiving experience. And so, and actually, celebrations should be small for all those other people out there, too, who aren't caregiving. But for the caregiver, it is especially true. It's especially important to celebrate small victories.
Yes.
You know, the small things that can happen during the day. For example, I'm a storyteller. I like to think of myself as one, and that's really why I wrote stories in this book, to illustrate the key points. But once I began to really engage my family members in the stories that I'd never heard them tell, and actually it's because I never asked them, right? Or maybe I didn't ask the more in-depth questions. It was amazing the things that I learned about my parents and about my husband, and I saw those as incredible moments of celebration when I found out, oh my gosh, my dad felt like this and I never knew that he'd felt like this before. Or my mother had a skill or an interest that I never knew she had. And so we would celebrate that, you know. And then I'm sure that they found out things about me. And so just celebrating the time together each day was really a victory. Other areas might be, you know, the day that you get up and you're going to the doctor. But as a caregiver, you figured out, you know, rather than just to make this a routine thing where, oh, my gosh, we've got to get up, got to go to the doctor, that you make it a moment or moments of interest. So creating some sort of a happy thing around that, going to the doctor, getting ice cream afterward, going to lunch before, going to a park and sitting on a bench. Those are the kinds of small celebrations that I think we need to take time out for, even in the most routine of caregiver tasks on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and I think this is a perfect segue also to talk about storytelling and caregiving as a transformative experience. That's a very big point for you towards the end of the book. I also want to talk about collaboration, but let's talk a little bit. Let's focus on transformative the transformative experience, because I don't think a lot of families out there realize while they're in the midst of caring for someone who is going through a terrible illness that this whole experience can, in fact, be transformative.
Yes. Stories are those things that connect us. They are the glue of what makes us human beings. And that's really how I view a story. And we all have lots of stories in us. So the more, as a caregiver, that you can engage the person you're caring for, and in fact the entire family, the context of the family, in stories, the more it will build trust and it will build collaboration. And it will be that glue that becomes the cement of your caring community. Because people, once you've told them a story about an experience you've had or a concern you have or a challenge you've met or a challenge you haven't met, and they do the same for you, there is that bonding that occurs that says we are all human. And there's that incredible explosion of understanding around, oh my gosh, I didn't know that about this person. And the more we know and the more we share stories, you know, our great-grandfathers and so on didn't have television and didn't have all these modern technological things, and they tended to sit at home in front of a fireplace, and even before that, people sat around campfires and told stories.
Right.
And so in many ways, their emotional needs were met much more clearly 200 years ago than they are today. We are a disconnected society. So as caregivers, the more that we can bring our families together and share stories, the more we're really reclaiming our families. And that's part of the enrichment. That's why I named the book Enrich Your Caregiving Journey. I think caregiving can bring us around to an enriched part of life that perhaps we haven't known for a long time. It's kind of sad that caring for someone is the thing that would bring us around, and
right.
Yet it is that thing that, you know, you got to go down in the valley in order to come up on the hill again.
True.
But it is storytelling that can help us do that. It can be truly transformative for our families.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more, and I couldn't agree with you more in terms of how that can really make our families much stronger and can unify us in ways that we never imagined.
Yes, yes. And by the way, the other thing that I think I've pointed out in an article or two that I've written for eCare Diary,
yes,
is that the stories don't have to be long. They can be short. They can be, you know, 6 or 7 sentences.
Right.
They don't have to be, sometimes I think maybe we think, like with celebrations, we think that stories need to be longer or bigger or something. But stories can be quite short, and yet we can glean a lot from them.
Right. And to your point about collaborating with the one being cared for, I think that's another important message from your book, which is that they're at the center of all of this. And I think, like with your other tools, you also provide a scale to understand the degrees to which they want to be involved with their own care. I mean, interestingly enough, there are a lot of patients who really don't want to be involved with the decision-making process. They want to entrust that to the caregiver, their son or daughter, or whomever else they, you know, their spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting you'd say that. And I would have agreed even more with you, say, even a couple of years ago. But I tend to think, and I'll link with your question and statement back to the art of storytelling.
Yes.
There are people who are low on the collaboration scale. And
yes.
You might think, gosh, they just don't want to be involved. And yet I found with my father that the more that he and I could sit down and just share, you know, stories about this and that and the other thing, and I could involve him on telling me about things. He was a great handyman type person. He was a farmer. And the more I engaged him on telling me about his life and what he liked to do and all this, the more I found he was collaborative, the more engaged he became. It was amazing. And I never would have believed that he would have, now he was never high on collaboration, mind you, but mm-hmm. he did get involved in thinking through some of the options and some of the decisions that we had to make. And I attribute that to engaging him in just talking about just telling me stories, and I with him.
Marjorie, I could talk to you forever about all these wonderful points in your book, and I think we're actually coming to a close now, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really a pleasure having you on and sharing your wealth of knowledge and aspects of your book. I'd like to thank our audience as well. Go ahead, Marjorie. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to thank you, Susan, and to remind everybody to think about asking for help.
Absolutely. I want to thank our audience for tuning in as well, and join us next time on Monday, July 26th at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern, when Laurel Kennedy will be our guest. She is the author of The Daughter Trap and will share the issues and solutions around being a sandwich generation caregiver. For caregivers seeking help and information, please visit www.ecarediary.com, ecarediary.com. You can also find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can follow me on ecarediarysusan on Twitter. Before I forget, Marjorie, can you tell us the best place to buy your book?
The best place is my website. It's www.pivotalcrossings.com. That's pivotal with a P, P-I-V-O-T-A-L, crossings, crossings.com. That's the best place to get it. I'm also on Amazon.com.
Yes, and what is the price of your book?
$19.95.
Terrific. It's a great value because you just offer invaluable tools for every family out there. I'm so glad I have it because we are dealing with a number of different issues now, new issues in my family, and I'm so glad to have this tremendous resource. For all of you out there, we encourage you to register to access all the free tools on ecarediary.com. One of our main tools is the Care Diary, which is a medication and appointment management tool. You can also receive occasional updates on our events and special offers by signing up for our newsletter on the homepage. Thank you all very much for joining us, and we will see you next time on July 26th.